is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 115, and I'm your host, Simon Baum. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, please join the Patreon campaign. There are now more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Dr. Michael P. Masters about his book, The Extratempestrial Model. Dr. Masters is a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Technical University. He received a PhD in anthropology from The Ohio State University, where he specialized in hominin evolutionary anatomy, archaeology, and biomedicine. Recent research examines the premise that UFOs and aliens could be our future human descendants returning to visit and study their own evolutionary past. Hi, Michael. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely, Simon. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called The Extratempestrial Model. I think at the beginning, you mentioned your father saw a UFO.
It was actually before I was born. He and a colleague were out. He was a veterinarian in a rural area of Northeast Ohio here in the U.S. And him and a colleague were out late at night. I think it was after midnight. And they crested a hill. And the way he described it was there was a big sort of glowing ball of light. He said it didn't really emanate light beams like, you know, you look at a street lamp or something like that. But it was just this glowing, obviously a shape to it, too. It wasn't just a light, but said it was sort of hovering probably about 100 feet off the ground. And all of a sudden it darted toward their truck and hovered just above them for a little bit of time and then darted back across to where it had been. Near the horizon, and then sat there for a little bit and then shot straight up into the sky at tremendous speed. So it was, you know, kind of a typical UFO sighting, I guess, if you can call it that. But yeah, it was interesting, too, that two people witnessed it, because it always gives more credibility. What Jalen Hynek in his book, The UFO Experience, dubbed reliability and strangeness. He had a whole scale to try to put in context some of these odd encounters. And if there's more people involved, it adds more reliability to the case, because there's other people that can vouch for the event. And it kind of stuck with him, I guess. And I overheard him telling that story when I was a kid. I was probably about 8 years old, and it apparently stuck with me as well.
I suppose since he'd had that experience, you grew up in a home where this sort of thing was, you know, it wasn't like a real skeptical home, and your dad would say, you don't want to believe in any of that nonsense.
Well, actually, no, it was kind of the opposite.
Oh.
he never talked about it. I just overheard him telling that story and asked him about it the next day. He's like, oh, nothing, you know, don't worry about it. Just not a big deal. And then I interviewed him about it when I was in college, because I started to become more interested in examining the phenomenon. And he told me the same story, recounted the events, but that was the first time he'd ever talked about it. And then he went on to say that, you know, I shouldn't be investigating this because it's the devil's work and it's trying to lead me away from God, I think were his exact words. So, yeah, he... like a lot of people who have strong religious affiliations, they seem to look at things that don't fit neatly in their worldview and just kind of cast them aside. Because a lot of people fear what they don't understand. And if you don't take the time to understand this, it can be something that is fearful. Or if you have strong religious beliefs, regardless of which religious system you adhere to, it doesn't fit neatly within that. So it tends to be something that is dismissed by people in that community.
So the book's called The Extratempestrial Model. So can you explain what that model is?
Yeah, sure. It's just the simple idea that rather than being extraterrestrials, they could potentially be these UFO occupants. They could potentially be us from the future coming back through time to visit and study their own hominin evolutionary past. So to indicate that in the term itself, I just removed terre, which is the Latin root for earth, meaning outside of earth, and replaced it with the Latin root for time, temp. So it just indicates that they are potentially, and again, I don't think this is mutually exclusive with the extraterrestrial hypothesis or any other model. And I certainly don't think it explains all of it either, as I've said from the beginning, but I do think we should consider the theory. And I think it could potentially explain some of the phenomenon, if not a large part of it. But the term itself is just to kind of keep with the common lexicon of extraterrestrial, which we all know what that means, and just kind of modify it slightly. So we can still keep ET as an acronym, just referring to something slightly different, that they may be us from the future as opposed to being extraterrestrials. And it's very possible, as my editor pointed out for that book, The Extratempestrial Model, it's very possible that humans in the future will go on to inhabit other planets and other star systems, at which point we would be both. We would be extratempestrial and extraterrestrial by definition, even if we had our common origins on this planet, and the same evolutionary history that we share with other hominins and primates and mammals and tetrapods. We would see ourselves as being different. Like I'm Welsh, all of my ancestors are Welsh, but when people ask me where I'm from, I say Ohio. I don't say that I'm from Wales, because it was longer ago that my ancestors lived there. So it's very possible that we do go on to inhabit other star systems and kind of see ourselves more as the inhabitants of those worlds, as opposed to our common origin here on Earth.
And you discuss in the book the problems with the extraterrestrial hypothesis, things like how would they find us in the first place and why would they even be interested in us?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that was pointed out by J. Allen Hynek's, one of J. Allen Hynek's sons, Paul Hynek. Why would they care? How would they find us, and why would they care? If they are us from the future, obviously it would be easy to find us because they exist on the same planet, or at least know of this planet, if it is a part of their ancestry as well. And why would they care in the same way that we care about our own ancestors and what they did? That's what I do as a paleoanthropologist, is look into the past and examine the fossil and dental history of our ancestors and see how we evolved both morphologically and culturally to become the way we are today. So it could be as simple as trying to understand more about their past, but there's also seemingly a very strong focus on gametes and DNA. Reproductive materials in general. So I think there's something more going on than just studying their past. But a lot of the things they do that are reported, people that are abducted and taken into these ships describe being subjected to something that seems very much like a medical exam, and things that are very similar to what I would do as a paleoanthropologist if I could go back in time and pick up living people instead of just studying the fossilized skeletal remains of our ancestors. If I could actually pick them up and, you know, study their living tissues as well, and their culture and society and political system and economic system and everything else that we could learn by observing them in real time as, you know, living entities that are part of a society, there's so much more information we could get from that. So it's definitely something that I think we should consider in the context of what people describe happening. The focus on the nuclear weapons, they've shut off nuclear warheads here in Montana, where I currently live as well. 10 of them were taken offline at the Malmstrom Air Force Base. And that's another aspect of maybe why they would care, because if they are set to inhabit this planet, if they're going to inherit it from us, they might be more inclined to take into consideration the vast destruction of the biome here on this planet if we were to nuke each other. And we probably seem extremely primitive and backwards to them, especially with our political infighting and just, you know, and if you take primitive monkey men and give them nuclear weapons, obviously that would be a point of concern. And we do see this correlation where the UFOs start showing up much more after Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all of the tests that were being done. And so, yeah, I think it is important to consider what we might expect from ourselves in the future versus what we might expect to see from extraterrestrials. They wouldn't be expected to care as much. It's unlikely that they would find us in the first place, that they would evolve to be so much like us, to be upright walking, bipedal humanoid forms, especially considering how rare bipedalism here is on this planet. We're the only upright walking mammal on this planet with a relatively low gravity, 9.8 meters per second squared, relatively small planet. Only about 4 to 6% of all of the planets that have been discovered so far, which is over 5,000 now, only 4 to 6% are the same size or smaller than Earth. So if bipedalism is so rare here, it's likely to be even rarer on other exoplanets, Earth-like exoplanets, because they're all much larger by comparison. So yeah, there's just a lot of things that seem to indicate that to get that form or to find us or to care about what we're doing here or to even know about us and to have this focus on dangerous weapons like nukes, I think there's a lot of things that seem to point to the fact that they may be us as opposed to being extraterrestrial.
People who are, you know, claim to be abducted or contactees, they talk about seeing different types of ETs. Some of them look very much like us. But then if you look at the greys, they look very different to us. Well, they're still like got two arms and two legs, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It could almost be like there's humans from a few thousand years in the future coming to see us, and then humans from hundreds of thousands of years in the future coming back, and they would be the greys?
Potentially. I designated that in my first two books, temporal variation, because we have modern human variation that we see today. It's a result of ancestry where people evolved. A lot of it you can see in skin color. Obviously, as you go closer to the equator, people have darker skin to protect them against ultraviolet A and B radiation, protect them against skin cancers. You go farther from the equator, you have lighter skin to absorb more of what little sun there is. And helps with metabolic pathways related to vitamin D synthesis and folic acid, which is really important for fetal brain development as well. So there's a lot of things that we have that we can attribute to human variation in modern times that are a result of our evolutionary history. So it's kind of that same concept, but if we see beings that are coming back from a lot of times I'll make the comparison where if we just look at us now and imagine ourselves going back in time, if we went back 100 years, we would look almost identical to the people in that region. If we went back in the same region that we lived in and shared ancestry with those people, if you go back 1,000 years, you might notice some differences. 50,000 years, we're going to start looking pretty different to those people. And then as you go back farther and farther, obviously, you stand out in a crowd. You have the bigger head, the bigger eyes, the smaller face, more sophisticated technology that allowed you to get there in the first place. And you could kind of see how you would be that alien to the people there. You would seem to have magical abilities just simply because they don't understand the physics and the technology and the material sciences. And it might be the same case, yeah, where the grays could potentially be 50, 60, 100,000 years in our future and therefore had more time to evolve into those forms. It's also possible that some of them, and there's cases where this seems to be indicated that some of the smaller grays in particular are potentially some sort of biological robot or droid or avatar who are tasked with certain things related to the abduction process or just, you know, carrying out the examination, the taking and the returning of the individual that's abducted. So there seems to be the potential for that as well, that maybe they're constructed, either they're biological or some sort of mechanical droid robot type thing that have a specific role to play. And that seems to be indicated by a lot of different cases where the taller grays are the ones that are sort of leading they're doing the examinations. They're sort of in control, not just of the smaller droid-like grays, but also humans, people that look just like modern-day humans, who may be a result of the process of hybridization. That sounds crazy to say, but there's a lot of indications that there is some sort of hybridization program, and that would be allowed for if they are the same species. We have this thing called the biological classifications of species concept, which is the oldest way in which we used to classify species. If two individuals can mate, reproduce, and produce viable offspring, then they're considered the same species. So that would seem to indicate that they are us and we are them as well, if that is actually part of the phenomenon.
And if you look at how humans have evolved over the last few hundred thousand years or more, can you see, looking at the greys, that there's a clear path to us evolving into that shape? Or is it would be weird for us to evolve into that shape?
No, that's kind of the main thing that got me involved in this, is I could see that path pretty clearly, even as a 8 or 9 year old kid. And then as I began to study it more deeply and more, I guess, meticulously with regard to focusing on craniofacial evolution throughout the hominin lineage, looking specifically at the eye orbits and how they change in relation to the neurocranium above the eyes growing out larger mediolaterally, also moving forward with frontal expansion, and the face shrinking and moving backward. It becomes reduced and retracted, as we say. So yeah, those trends, that's the main trend throughout hominin evolution, is that our brains expand, move forward, especially move mediolaterally, expand outward on the parietal lobes at the top and the back of the skull. So we've become, we have what's called neurocranial globularity, where we have this big round skull and a little tiny face. And that's, it's occurred throughout the 6 to 8 million year history of hominins, but has been accelerating in recent time over the last 800,000 years, and especially in the last 300 to 500,000 years. So if that same trend continues, and it's likely to, I don't see any reason why the same trend that's existed for 6 million years in our ancestors would just all of a sudden stop. And in fact, it has been accelerating, which seems to indicate that it would continue to do that as well. We're likely to look exactly like them. Bigger, more rounded heads, smaller faces, increased consciousness and cognition, increased technology, more advanced technology. So yeah, a lot of the things that we see throughout the hominin past, if they continue, are likely to result in exactly what we see potentially in what's coming back from the future. So and I really went out of my way in the extratempestrial model in my first book, Identified Flying Objects, to not speculate about what might happen between now and then. A lot of people would write me and say, well, yeah, if we live in space or we have to go underground, then we develop bigger eyes and all this stuff. And I really shied away from that and instead just focused on what we can know based on what we see happening, not just in these long-term morphological changes, but also long-term societal and cultural changes. Just how those might result in the forms that we see in these UFO contact cases. It seems to be a common thread that unites them.
And if we look at the universe, how old it is, how old our galaxy is, which is around 13.5 billion years, mm-hmm. and the chances of other intelligent life evolving at other places in our galaxy, for them to evolve to be intelligent and able to travel through space at exactly the same time that we evolve and become intelligent and have a civilization, the chances of the two happening at the same time and then them finding us, that's quite a high number, isn't it? The chances of it are very small.
Yeah, and yeah, I touched on the morphological aspect a little bit, but you're right, the time aspect is super important as well. When we're talking about something like 13, 14 billion years, the likelihood that we would get an upright walking hominin that has bilateral symmetry, eyes, nose, mouth in the same location, that has four limbs, they're tetrapods, pentadactyly, they have five digits at the end of each of those limbs, they can breathe our air, they can communicate our languages, they can have sex with us. There's just all of these things that make it really unlikely that we would not only get that on another planet close enough to us that they could locate us and travel here, but that it would happen at the same time within that 14 billion year period, that they would find us and happen to look so much like us and just happen to be slightly more evolved in their physical form and technology at the same time, essentially. And 14 billion years is a tremendously long period of time. If the universe was only, you know, say 5,000 years old or something, yeah, it's more likely that within that time frame you could get things that happen to match up at the same time. But when we're talking about 14 billion years, it's just, it's unfathomable that all of those things could just happen to come together in the right way to get such a similar being on a close enough planet that just happens to be slightly more advanced.
And you talk about the theory of time travel. For example, you know, if you had a craft that could travel close to the speed of light and it shot off somewhere a few light years away and came back, the people on Earth would have aged a lot more than the people on board the craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's just the twins paradox. It's an aspect of special relativity that Einstein laid out, and I think it was 1905 paper. And yeah, it's just an aspect of the fact that, at least as far as we understand it now, that everything is relative to the speed of light, both time and space. So you're compressing time and space as you travel away from the Earth at tremendous speed. And then basically, if you looked back as you're leaving Earth, it would look like everything stopped because you are leaving with the light that you left with, essentially, if you're traveling at near the speed of light. But then when you come back, you're blasting through all of those moments, moving against the light that's coming from the planet. And by the time you land on Earth, yeah, you see that a tremendous amount of time has passed, depending on how long you were gone. So if you, say, went at near the speed of light to the end of the galaxy and back, you traversed our Milky Way galaxy, which would take about 22 years on your spaceship, but you get back and roughly 100,000 years had passed on Earth. So yeah, that's simple time travel into the future, just as a result of time dilation, as indicated in that twins paradox example. But traveling backward in time, there's been a number of solutions to Einstein's field equations that were published with his 1915 paper about general relativity, which took into account mass and the warpage of space-time and energy as well, because mass and energy are equivalent. And all of these solutions very early on after he published that paper, beginning with Lenz and Thuring in 1917, just a couple years later, showed that with the rotation of a massive or highly energetic object, you can bend light cones over. So you can not violate any of the laws of physics and still travel into the past because your light cone, all of the things that are possible within the boundaries of light, essentially is what that represents. You can still move forward locally in space-time, but because your light cone is tilted, you can move into the past in a global space-time capacity. So it doesn't violate any known laws of physics. Most likely what they're doing involves something that we don't yet understand. It may take the combination of general relativity and quantum mechanics, some sort of grand unified theory. So we clearly don't understand exactly what they're doing or how they're doing it or what material sciences are involved, but there's nothing in the known laws of physics today that prohibits backward time travel. And I cited a couple papers in my first book by Ehrman et al. That showed that. They did a massive review of all of the literature and deduced that there's nothing that violates the laws of physics as we understand them today. And these things also seemingly have the ability to manipulate space-time. And that's one of the things I brought out a lot in my second book, The Extratempestrio Model, is just how many cases indicate that. Just there's a lot of events that transpire that really strikingly show that these things are in fact time machines, that they're able to bend and warp and manipulate space time within the vicinity of these craft.
And you mentioned in the book about contactees and abductees, and they occasionally report being returned at the same moment they were taken.
Pretty close. Yeah. There's two cases that jump out. There's the case of Corporal Armando Valdez, 1977, I believe, in Chile. And he was stationed out in the middle of nowhere, a very rural mountainous area in Chile, toward the northern part of the country. And this two UFOs came down. One came very close to his platoon, and being in charge, he walked toward it, disappeared from the sight of his men. They couldn't see him any longer. And when he reemerged, it was 15 minutes, according to their calculations. But he had aged 5 days based on the amount of beard growth. He had been cleanly shaven. And when he reemerged, he had a lot of stubble growing on his face. And also importantly, his watch read 5 days in the future. And that's the one thing watches do, clocks, is they measure time, the passage of time. So it seems to indicate that he was gone for 5 days, or the craft sort of sped up time within its vicinity. But there's clearly a disconnect there. But the one that really shows this is the case of Amy Rylance in Australia, where she was seen taken out of her window while she was sleeping, through her window into a large standard UFO saucer-shaped craft on a beam of light. By her friend Petra, who just happened to wake up because of a thunderstorm and came out and saw this happening. And she's freaking out, and her husband wakes up, Amy Rylance's husband, who was the one taken, and they're looking for her all over, couldn't find her, call the police. They come about an hour later. So by this point, she'd been gone for an hour and a half, and the police are starting to suspect that they murdered her, that there's some sort of weird love triangle, and that Petra and her husband just offed her and hit her in the woods or something. But then suddenly they get a call on the phone that Amy was found 790 kilometers away in a completely different city. And they went up to Mackay, where she was in Australia, and she was being checked out by the hospital staff. The nurses concluded that she was actually gone for quite some time. She was dehydrated. She was malnourished. And Amy herself remembers all of this. She was conscious for a lot of it and said she was with a man in this ship, and she was with them for 5 to 7 days. So that seems to indicate that they brought her back, not to the same place. And they specifically told her ahead of time they weren't going to drop her off in the same place, but they did drop her close enough to a petrol station that she could get help. And this is a common theme. The same thing happened with Travis Walton, or he's dropped off in a remote location, but close enough to a highway and a petrol station that he could use a payphone and call for help. So they seemingly do care about us and make attempts to take care of us. And the vast majority of cases, at least, there's obviously always exceptions. But yeah, the fact that Amy Rylance was dropped off, if she was actually gone for, let's say, 5 days, but she was brought back to a time closer to when she was taken, most likely to allay the fears of her husband and her friend Petra, who saw this happen, and also the police. There were three different police jurisdictions involved in this case. She swore under oath that these things happened, and she could be prosecuted if she was found to be lying. So yeah, there's a number of cases that do indicate that time is being manipulated, and such as these other two cases, and especially the Amy Rylance one, that they do have the ability to travel through time when needed.
And you mentioned Travis Walton there, and he's one of the case studies in your book, and you've got a whole ton of really great case studies. So could you just briefly tell us, what are the case studies? How have you put them together? And then maybe we can talk about Travis Walton.
Right, sure. So my first book was kind of, it's been called dense many times. It's a very scientific examination of this theory and how it might work and why we should consider this. It focuses on astronomy, astrobiology, physics, and anthropology primarily. But for my second book, I kind of flipped the script, where I didn't really talk about individual cases too much. I did a little bit, but it's mostly laying out the groundwork for this hypothesis. But then the second book, I mostly started with 15 case studies. And overall, there's probably about 30 that are mentioned or described, but with a focus on these 15 individual studies. What I did is I took these 15 case studies and about 30 probably in general that are brought in amongst those, and then brought the science in on top of that. So sort of interject the science into these cases, as opposed to just starting with the science and then kind of touching on a few different cases. And I wanted broad representation. So it covers about a 90-year period on 5 different continents to show how there's a lot of similarity among these cases, regardless of when they happened or where they happened. There's patterns that emerge. And so what I was trying to do is really focus on those patterns and what we can learn from them. So sort of teasing those out in association with things like the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Free study that currently has over 5,000 abductees, contactees. So they surveyed these people to tease out what's happening to people, who they describe seeing, what sorts of things happen to them. And they've demonstrated that the majority of people come into contact with other people, that they describe them as human is the most common form. And then the short grays, then the tall grays, and then hybrids. And importantly, all four of those are by definition upright walking hominins, which is important to consider that, you know, we're talking about people. We're talking about humans that have the same morphological form. They do similar things. Just in looking at these cases, going back to the early 1900s and then finishing up with the Tic Tac case, which took place in, I think, 2004, 2005, and then more contact cases in 2014, 2015 with these U.S. aircraft carriers, U.S. Navy, just that broad range of time, and then also looking across 5 different continents and just seeing what emerges. And there are a lot of patterns that emerge that seem to indicate that they are future humans, but I also consider cases that don't necessarily point to that. I wasn't just trying to cherry pick the ones that do. But I break down the Betty and Barney Hill case, because, you know, Betty Hill was allegedly shown a star map and told they come from a different planet. And it's, again, it's possible that it's both, that they did come from that planet, but they also maybe still have their origins here on Earth, as I described at the top of the show. Just looking at other models too, not just this extratempestrial model, but the crypto-terrestrial, ultra-terrestrial, extraterrestrial, obviously. And what we could learn from these various cases of close contact, because they've been dismissed for so long and people unfortunately still aren't comfortable talking about it. We're still just stuck on cockpit videos and the craft themselves. But at some point we're going to have to face the fact that there's beings inside and people have come into contact with them, and we should take their accounts seriously and consider those. So I dedicated that book in particular to the people that were brave enough to talk about this, because it's the only way we can really learn what's going on.
And with Travis Walton, he woke up inside the craft with a group of greys around him, but then he encountered the human-looking, I'll call them ETs. So it appears that they're all working together in whatever they're doing around the Earth.
Yeah, it would seem so. And his is an interesting case. He kind of sees it as a medical intervention, like an ambulance call of sorts, because he walked up to this thing. They clearly weren't expecting that. And there was an electrostatic discharge that shocked him and sent him flying back through the air and knocked him unconscious. His friends took off, or his coworkers at least, took off down the hill in their pickup truck. And when they came back, he was gone. The ship was gone. And they apparently picked him up and started treating him, saved his life after he was subjected to this electromagnetic discharge. And when he woke up, he assumed he was in a hospital because his body hurt. And then he looked around and saw these quintessential short gray types who, again, you know, I don't know. It's hard. Like, are they something that was made? Are they living? These ones in particular seem to have volition. They seem to be alive. They seem to have a soul, if we can use that word. Whereas others are much more robotic, like the ones that initially took Whitley Strieber from his cabin in upstate New York. He describes them as being the opposite, that they seem to be robotic and just kind of following directions. And there's another case that is kind of interesting. A woman and her husband and her friend were taken from the French Quarter in New Orleans, a very busy area, but these entities, these beings, the UFO occupants, seemingly sort of stopped time in that area to facilitate this abduction. And in the first case study in that second book, The Extratempestrio Model, is the case of Mike and Leo Dorshak. And they specifically said that they do that. That he walked up to the craft and he's like, these lights are so bright. Aren't you afraid people will see you? And they said, you noticed that there was no movement as you approached the ship. We stopped time within a 3-mile radius of the craft. And we allowed you to walk through because we know you. He had known them his entire life, pretty much. But everything else has been stopped, and they can stop animate objects. They showed them. They have this little wand where they froze a rabbit, and they use that to pick people up and make it safer for them, and clearly to hide themselves as well. And it may be the opposite too, that they slow down time as they're flying around. They may be zipping around the skies all the time, but we just don't see them because they move faster than the frames per second that we can compute in our brains, which is something like 30 or 35 frames per second. So they may be using that manipulation of time to sort of cloak themselves in addition to using it to pick people up. But the reason I mentioned the woman in the French Quarter of New Orleans is that she was taken and she was standing at the edge of a crater, looking down into this crater at like a base, and most likely she was on the moon. It's pretty obvious that there is a moon base and it's been there for some time, on the far side of the moon at least. And yeah, there's this woman, a human woman with long blonde hair. She said she was absolutely beautiful and she spoke telepathically and she felt this sort of all-encompassing love and light that so many people describe. And she was taken by those grays, but she said that over to her left, on the other side from where the woman was standing next to her, they were laying on top of each other in kind of a dog pile, but staggered. So like one was laying head to toe, the other laid across them in the opposite direction, kind of making a cross or an X shape, belly down, and they were stacked up on top of each other, which would seem to indicate that they are some sort of an automaton, a robot or droid or avatar of some sort. And they're just kind of resting because they're not being used, possibly powering up. I don't know. But at the same time, there's this human woman who clearly is more evolved or possibly some sort of hybrid because she has these abilities. She exudes this empathy and this higher consciousness and has the ability to communicate telepathically. And the woman who was taken said she felt an absolute calm, like this presence that just washed over her. And she, even though she, you know, it's a very strange scenario, she's standing on the moon with these gray aliens stacked up next to her, she felt no fear or anxiety at all, which is also pretty commonly described. And so yeah, I think and in the case of Travis Walton too, he did initially wake up with the grays, but then he ran out of the room, went into the control room, pushed some buttons, and then to intervene, they brought in these very beautiful looking humans again that he described and others have described as having a sort of familial look to them, that they look like they're related in some way, which would again seem to indicate that there is a hybridization happening. They're using some of the same individuals' reproductive materials to create these forms for whatever reason they're selected. I don't know. And then they took him out into a different area. He walked through a hangar, again, most likely on the far side of the moon, the sort of UFO base that other individuals described seeing too. Terry Loveless, Jerry Wills, I mentioned them as well in that book. And they take him into a room, and another group of humans, a woman in particular, puts a mask over his face. It makes him fall asleep, makes him unconscious. And the next thing he knows, he's back on Earth in the woods, going to call for help. So yeah, it's interesting in a lot of cases. Again, Whitley Strieber's as well. Terry Lovelace described this too, where you have different looking humans, still human forms, with the suite of evolutionary characteristics. Some are more like the grays, some are more like us, some are sort of hybrids in between, and some are even modern humans in military garb, who are walking around contributing, who are clearly working with them, that may even be from this time. They may be part of these programs that are happening as a part of a military branch from, you know, the US, UK, Russia, who knows. But they look just like us, and they wear the same military outfits with the same insignia that we use too. So yeah, there's seemingly a lot of different things going on, but it would seem to indicate that there is more collaboration than what we're presently aware of.
And it's interesting you say that it was Leo and Mike, was Dorshak. That was 1932. I think you said that they had a area 3 miles around the craft where they had frozen stuff, because there's this thing that it's called the Oz factor, isn't it, where everything around you seems to go silent when you're close to a UFO. And I talked to a guy the other day for an episode, and he was saying how he was a child and he was with a group of children, and he looked round and the others were just kind of frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few seconds later, a girl said to him, "Where have you been?" And he was, "Well, I haven't been anywhere. What do you mean?"
Yeah. Yeah, there's cases where people have been taken from their dining room table as they're eating dinner with their family. Just everybody all of a sudden freezes. And next thing they know, they're the only one that's animated. Yeah, it's really common. They can clearly shut people down. They can keep people asleep. They can make them fall asleep. But it's selective. They can do it to certain people. It's not just that they have to freeze everything in an area and everyone is frozen, but like the case with Mike Dorshak specifically, or Leo Dorshak, sorry, his little brother Mike died in the Korean War. But yeah, and the woman in the French Quarter in New Orleans, there were other people. They thought it was strange that there was nobody out. It was like a time where there's a lot of people out partying. And they were excited to go out and party, but there was nobody. And they went into one bar, it was just a bartender. Nobody else was in there. They went to another place and it was closed. They went to another place, there was a doorman at a club where there's never a doorman. And there was nobody inside. So clearly certain individuals were a part of the subduction process, and they were tasked with sort of moving them in a specific way at a specific time to make the subduction happen. But they were allowed to be moving, whereas everyone else was frozen. And you wouldn't notice anything. If the only way we register the passage of events is the passage of time. So if everything's frozen and you're frozen and there's no ability to register things as they happen because there's no time, then you essentially just take those people out of the equation. You start time back up and they feel like nothing has happened at all. They might sense a little glitch or something, but, and I highlighted this in my third book, which is actually a satirical time travel novel. It's scientific in the sense. It's kind of I think they call it hard science fiction because it does bring a lot of the same science into it. Where I elucidated that concept and this freezing of time and how it's easy to manipulate people even in populated areas because they have that capacity to freeze and stop and manipulate the flow of time. Because I always wondered that too. I'm glad that Leo Dvorak asked him, because I was always curious how they can abduct someone from an apartment in New York City or someone in Los Angeles. And yeah, it's really interesting that they have that capability, and further indicates that they are masters of time. That they figured out the way to use this temporal tool to their advantage to essentially do whatever they want, whenever they want, and remain hidden in the process.
And Leo and Mike, they encounter this UFO with these occupants several times as the years went past. But I think they said every time they met the occupants, they hadn't aged, even though years had passed.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I'm glad you brought that up. And It's one of many cases like that where they meet the same people. We can call them people because they were. They meet the same people throughout their lives. And with Mike and Leo, their first encounter was when they were kids. They saw this craft and they saw the people outside of it collecting grasshoppers and doing jumping jacks and exercising. And over time, they're aware of these boys watching them. And over time, they stopped putting up the force field that kept them out. This invisible shield that would stop them as they tried to approach the craft. And eventually they let them come up to them. They brought out someone who spoke 500 languages who could communicate with them. I think they were German immigrants and they spoke both German and English with them. They were allowed to go on the craft. They had to do a little decontamination thing. They were given fresh clothes and then they were allowed to go on the craft and gotten a tour of it. And then, yeah, throughout his life, and on into old age, he eventually moved near Bozeman, Montana, and saw the same craft with the same people again later in life. And yeah, importantly, they didn't age at all. He had gone through his entire life. He was now an older man, but these individuals who he'd met when he was kids were, they looked exactly the same. And that again seems to indicate that they might be coming through time. And I make the analogy in my second book where you could study someone throughout their entire life in the matter of a couple days. So you could be tasked with, you know, you're assigned to study this individual. You pick them up when they're 8, pick them up again when they're 20, 40, 80, and you can do a long-term longitudinal study, which is where you get the most information. They take forever in modern times because we have to wait for the passage of time in order to get the results from this longitudinal study to process the statistics. You need all of the data available. But if you have the ability to go through time, you can jump into each of these points in their life as they age throughout growth and development and into senescence. But you could do that over the course of a couple of days. So of course you would look the same age. You wouldn't seem to age at all, even though they've gone through an entire lifetime, simply because you're doing this jumping through time into these individual points to collect that data. So yeah, it may have been what the people that Mike and Leo Dworshak met, what they were doing was ecological. They told them that they were picking up, they were studying, I think the specific verbiage that they used was that they were studying the ecology of the planet through time as our planet got deeper into trouble, I think is what they said. So it's like, That's interesting in itself because it indicates that they know the future. They know what's coming and they're studying sort of this demise of the planet that they most likely call home as well. So they were picking up grasshoppers and other insects to study the ecology, but a lot of people do seemingly study people too. And that's our interest as anthropologists and especially biological anthropologists. And that's what I would do as well, is pick people up and study them throughout a lifetime. And yeah, in that process, if I was doing that, I wouldn't seem to age at all.
We have a lot of people who talk about being abducted, and some of them will say that it's a horrible experience, and some of them say that it's not that bad. And it almost seems like there are at least two different groups out there, maybe time travelers, ETs, and they have a different agenda from each other. And it also seems like, you know, maybe one group could come in and protect another group, but they don't do that.
Yeah, it's complicated. I definitely don't claim to have any answers there. One thing I do wonder about a lot is if there are other groups, if there's competing groups, if there's some with better intentions, some with mal intentions, or because that is certainly a possibility. Or is it people's perception of the events where they are taken, these things are done to them, standard types of examination procedures, etc., and they're horrified by it. There's a lot of ontological shock. There's like, there's no way this happened. This isn't a part of our reality. They can't tell anybody about it because they'll think they're crazy. But these things are happening to very well-adjusted, upstanding members of society. It really runs the gamut. We have the stereotype of drunk hillbillies, you know, getting picked up in the forest, but that's not the case. It's really people from all walks of life. And the reason I mention that is because a lot of them, again, Whitley Strieber is probably the best example. They're horrified. They feel violated. There's other people in your mind. You know, it's not just the anal probes and the examinations, but having someone else in your head, in your mind with you is a little tough at first. There's a violation of sorts because you feel that this is your mind and you have a sense of ego, and then that's destroyed when there's other people in it. But then over time, a lot of them come to recognize with repeated contact, and they showed this in the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Free study as well, that 85% of people who came into contact with human-looking forms, and again, that's most of them, had a benign or pleasant experience. And some are shown the inside of the ship. They get tours. They'll sit down and have conversations with them. Some have sex, like consensual, enjoyable sex with them. Antonio Vias Boas in Brazil is one of those examples, who I also mentioned in that second book. So, yeah, I wonder how much of it is competing groups with different intentions versus how people initially experience it and understand their experiences and have fear of those. And then over time, it's not that the people changed. It's not that the visitors were different or better. It's just that they were able to conceptualize what happened to them in the context of what had happened previously. And now it's a part of their consensus reality, at least individually, not our consensus reality as a society, as a global society right now. But they were at least able to have some foundation on which to stand, some ability to comprehend what's happening to them. Okay, I've done this before. I know these people. And what's really interesting is that in a lot of cases, the people that are lifelong contactees, it's the same person that they interact with their entire life. It's almost like they assign, these visitors assign like an ambassador or a concierge of sorts to sort of usher them through this process, starting from when they're very young. And in older age, they remember that same person who was apparently assigned to their case, sort of like a caseworker of sorts. And they feel comfort in that because they know that person. So it's almost like they are studying us in this capacity, and they want to mitigate the negative effects of it in many cases, because you're right, there's others. Even if there is repeated contact, it's negative, it's bad, they hate it. So that can't explain all of it. But I often wonder what level of those two scenarios, and likely others that I'm not considering, but which of those plays into it more? Is it that they are changing the way they perceive the experiences over time, versus are there different groups with different intentions and that run the spectrum from good to bad, however we conceptualize that?
I could talk to you for another hour, but we've just about run out of time. And it's, you know, you kind of suggested this thing where, like Roswell, for instance, they crashed the flying saucer on purpose so we could start our time machine development. But we haven't got time to go into it.
You got to wonder, too, and not just about the time machines, but the energy involved. If they've mastered zero-point energy, for instance, cold fusion, if they have the ability to, if they have technologies that we don't yet but could benefit from, there's all of these things that come with it, not just the ability to eventually travel through time or explore the solar system or the galaxy, but potentially all of the things that come with it that make those craft able to work in the first place, that could solve a lot of problems that we face here on Earth in modern times.
Well, the book's called The Extratempestrial Model, and people can get that on Amazon, can't they, with your other books?
Yeah, all three of them are on Amazon and other booksellers. Also, if people want to go to a bookstore, just go ask them, and there's wholesale versions available. I make much less money from those, but it's also good to support local brick and mortar bookstores, so I always advocate that people do that as well.
And do you have a website?
Yep. Website is michaelpmasters.com. And there's links to the books through there. Also an Etsy page where I do signed copies, at least for people in the US. I've tried to do it for people in the UK and Europe, but It's prohibitively expensive with shipping, unfortunately. But for folks in the US, I do sign copies through the Etsy page, and there's a link on the website there too. Also a contact form if people want to reach out about anything. But yeah, again, that's just michaelpmasters.com.
Great. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely, Simon. It's great talking to you.
And that was an interview with Dr. Michael P. Masters about his book, The Extratempestrial Model. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Our Paranormal Afterlife, and there are over 300 episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. You kind of say in the book that people report seeing these UFOs materializing and dematerializing, which helps towards, I suppose, a multidimensional model. But you argue against the multidimensional model in a way?
I guess I kind of consider this extratempestrial model a subset of, or a part of in some way. I'm not exactly sure how. Of the multidimensional or interdimensional, whatever you want.